And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And again, thank you to Alexander Mellis, great car guy, auto mechanic, and of course, Alexander's All Care Automotive Repair right there at 3310 East Thomas Road. And now, of course, it is a magnificent show starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon all the way from Houston, Texas. Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4. Guys, how are you? I just saw you yesterday.
Doing well.
Doing all right.
You're still doing well after yesterday, 24 hours later.
Yeah.
Here we are.
It's been a pretty neutral 24 hours.
A neutral 24, not well, an actually, exciting
not,
one?
Actually, that's not exactly true for me. But no, I'm
really?
About,
we want to hear all the details.
Same. No, you don't.
Yes,
you really
we do.
Don't.
Do we? Paul, you know
he's
the
like,
details.
No, she forced it on me and I didn't want to hear
Look,
it.
Look, I'll bribe you. I have money in my pocket.
No, I was just thinking we've only got an hour for
oh,
the show.
Oh, that's right. It's a good point. So symptoms and diagnosis we're going to talk about today. After that great show, by the way, yesterday.
Yeah, we talked yesterday about the DSM-5, the upcoming edition of the Diagnostic Manual for Mental
Disorders.
And so what we wanted to talk about a little bit today is what the process for diagnosis has looked at in the past. Kim's worked with a lot of people on the autism spectrum who have a diagnosis. So just sort of what it can look like to get a diagnosis, to see doctors, and maybe a little bit about what changes in the process might or might not mean going forward.
Well, you know, thinking about symptoms, and this is kind of interesting because I kind of relate it. I mean, for people in the community or even new parents, you know, sometimes people have this idea of autism, what the symptoms are supposed to be based on movies or things like that. So sometimes, you know, if their child has maybe more subtle symptoms, they wouldn't even consider it something to worry about necessarily. But traditionally, you know, observable symptoms, you know, would be things like sometimes very literal or concrete type language. And a lot of times I see that mostly with some of the adults that I work with, where it's really kind of hard for them to understand, you know, words in a flexible sense or read intent behind words, but solely focus on the words. So that's something I see more in adults. But, you know, and in children, sometimes it could just be kind of means to an end communication, like just asking for certain things, like things that they need versus sharing type language, things like that. So when people think of symptoms, communication, I think, is a big one on the top of the list that people notice right away because it's obvious that there's some kind of breakdown or something not going smoothly as it should. And the other thing I think that's kind of classic symptom that people talk about is lack of eye contact. And of course, as a culture, we're so used to it being a natural thing and a part of our interactions that when it's not happening, it seems very odd. And so people have actually, you know, attached that to autism in that children especially, I think, in my experience, really show that quite more clearer, I think, than some of the adults that I've worked with.
So are you saying, let's take eye contact. Are you saying like, let's say in children, if they don't have eye contact, it's possible they can be on the spectrum?
It's a potential warning sign.
It's a potential warning
right.
sign. Okay. I don't know if you have the stats, if everyone that has doesn't have eye contact, how many
no.
would be or wouldn't. I'm just sort
well,
of curious
well,
about
it's,
that.
The thing is it's a spectrum.
Yeah.
And the right amount of eye contact is a very subjective thing as well. Like, you know, are they making less eye contact than your kids or your last kid? Are they making less eye contact than your neighbor's kid? Are they making no eye contact? Are you not seeing it when they're making eye contact? So it's one of those things that is in a large way up to interpretation because what you're sort of looking at is less specifically the eye contact than the referencing. What are they getting from your emotional state? And eye contact is a way that we do the referencing, that we use eye contact to pick up the emotional state of others and to interpret it. So, you know, talking about, you know, they aren't making it, you know, you also need to look at, you know, if you can spot reasons or if you can spot difficulties that they're having because they're not making it. So it's just something that can tell you to start paying attention to other things that are going on more than something that you go, oh, they're not making eye contact. My kid might have autism.
And I would suspect that you want to keep your mind wide open and awareness, and that's what you're talking about, that obviously there could be self-esteem issues too with lack of eye contact.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because there are so many reasons that a person may not make what one person thinks is enough eye contact. Now, truly, the way I kind of see it and measure it is you think about what's typical in typical development. Because everybody will have their own amount of, and I don't even like this word eye contact, this phrase, but as we're talking about it, it's developmentally, what is someone doing? What is their intent behind the eye contact? And so, like Paul was saying, is we actually don't make eye contact to make eye contact. That's not what we do. We actually use our eyes to receive information about things we're observing. So in this case, it would be people. And so individuals on the spectrum, we're talking about kids. I mean, it's a little bit more pronounced, I think, sometimes in kids, because when you're an adult, people might just attribute it to confidence or shyness or whatever. But when you're a kid, I think it stands out a little bit more in that, you know, are they looking to me for information? Not just are they looking at me, or are they observing me? Are they, you know, able to share affect with me? Because that's all related to the eye contact. So the observable, you know, behavior, the thing that you could call a potential symptom, is lack of eye contact. That's something that's very observable, but there's a whole meaning and deficit behind that action. It's not just they're not able to move their eyes to look at me. It's not that. It's much deeper than that.
Sort of like, I'm going to say it, I haven't said it in months, but NLP, nonverbal communication, you're looking, as you both said, referencing and also getting information, is what, it's like opening another channel. What else can you see that you don't hear?
And, well, another part of it is that for someone on the spectrum, having that other channel open can be overwhelming. So they may be avoiding eye contact because they're trying to keep from being overstimulated. So it may be that they don't value it. I know typically for me, for the longest time, I wasn't making a lot of eye contact or watching people's faces because I was focusing on the words more than anything else. And so I didn't really put as much weight to the facial expression and the eyes as other people might have. But other people on the spectrum might be avoiding eye contact because they've just got enough to keep up with just trying to, you know, listen to the words as quickly as people are talking and throwing things at them, that the eye contact may put them into a state of like over anxiety.
Yeah,
so
overwhelmment.
You know, so they may not be making eye contact, but there can also be different reasons for not making eye contact. So the eye contact itself is a symptom that sort of cues you to look for, you know, underlying causes. Why aren't they making eye contact? Is this an autism thing? Is this something else? But it's just one of those signs that can help start you looking toward, you know, saying, well, maybe something isn't right here. And that's, I mean, I guess that's really the starting point for a lot of people, is just this feeling that something isn't right, and then you start looking for what set off that feeling.
So, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's, you know, so we're talking about symptoms, and symptoms are things that you can see, you know, or observe on the outside. And there's kind of two sides to that, because you always want to make sure that, yes, what you're seeing can lead you to, you know, say, hey, something isn't right here. What I'm seeing isn't adding up, or it doesn't feel natural. So you want to take that, but you also don't want to ultimately just take that and teach, okay, well, he's not doing this, how do we make him do this? It's very important that you understand or start to investigate why and the purposes of those things.
Like, for example, with eye contact again, I mean, the main reason you see it as a problem is because it puts you off. That when someone isn't making eye contact with you, it makes you uncomfortable. So if you're just treating it by teaching them eye contact, you may feel better with your interactions with that person. But if you don't identify whether they're not making eye contact because they don't value it, or they're not making eye contact because it overwhelms them, or they're not making eye contact because of some other reason you haven't figured out, then once you teach them to make eye contact, they still probably aren't going to be getting much from it. They're going to be looking you in the eyes and just throwing that information away because you've trained them to make eye contact, but you haven't really addressed whatever reason they're not making it. And whether that's going to improve or not is still going to depend on them, you know, going from make eye contact to being able to handle that information in a useful way. So, you know, again, diagnosis is a thing about symptoms, but treatment is a thing about the underlying causes of, you know, wanting to inspire them to value eye contact and want to make eye contact versus teaching them to make eye contact and hoping that that works its way down.
Because, yeah, it really doesn't usually do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is very much about the thing with diagnosis, though, is it's always going to be based around symptoms. That, you know, that you cannot look into a person's head. Well, these days with fMRIs, you can to an extent.
Actually, you can.
But until you've got a reason to hook that machine up and until we have enough data to be able to look at an MRI scan and say, yep, that's autism right there with 90% certainty, what you've got is symptoms. So we're talking about, you know, how how that takes place is that you start seeing symptoms that give you clues to look at one cause or another.
Now, some of the listeners right now will say, oh, okay, I may have seen that in my child or whatever, but what's the hope? In other words, I don't mean to go into treatment right now. However, I will ask just in context to if you see something, can you decrease the overwhelm if that's one of the cases and learn how to observe and understand nonverbal communication? Is that a teachable skill for people on the spectrum?
Yes, it is. Hope. I don't use the word skill, but it's a teachable process.
Okay, it is. And I understand that. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Process.
Ideally,
skill.
You don't want it to be a skill because a skill is something you think about, and normal people don't spend time thinking about that. So,
you're right.
You know,
I mean,
it's stressful if it's still
a
skill.
But I understand. No, to someone in the community listening, that makes perfect sense to think of those things as skills. And that's the thing is so we're trying to distinguish, and maybe we're going round and round a little bit, but symptoms and diagnosis are things you see that is a behavior or not a behavior. And so it would appear that this person either has the skill or doesn't have the skill. So in terms of, you know, understanding symptoms to actually, you know, be able to understand what diagnosis a person might have, yes, you look at those things. But treating it, you don't really look at those things the same. You identify them. But you don't just say, okay, these are the things we need to work on. You have to understand developmentally what those things mean. You have to understand a person's sensory system. You know, there's a lot of evaluation to be done, actually, because, well, number one, a person is just a person to start. So, yeah, there could be, you know, personality-related things or stress-related things or, you know, stuff like that. But then there's the sensory system. There's communication assessments. You know, there's skill assessments like, can this person pick up an item? Can this person understand a direction? You know, there are things like that. But when it comes to some of the core symptoms, I guess you could say, of autism, communication, you know, social, the eye contact, those things are just beyond behavior. But when we see them or we don't see them, it's like, they are doing or they're not doing.
And that's just, it's so important to start looking for causes. But diagnosis doesn't have to care as much about causes. That diagnosis, you do want to identify the causes, but they can be very hard to identify without, you know, months or years of observation. And the idea with diagnosis is that it gives you criteria to narrow things down. That it's a list of things and says, well, you know, autism shows this, and this. If they have at least three of these, it's 90% likely that what they've got is autism. It makes what they have most likely to be autism. It doesn't guarantee that's what they have, but studies show that, you know, if these conditions are met, it's of the things we know that exist, autism is the most likely one. And it's like, imagine a person that you see limping. They could have a sprained ankle or they could have a pebble in their shoe. And if they've spent, you know, the last month or so with whatever's causing the limp, and they've never addressed it for whatever reason, if you want to help them with it, you need to figure out which of those things it is. And if it's the pebble in the shoe, you might be able to just remove it, and they'll be fine. They may have to relearn to walk a little bit so as to put normal weight on that foot. But if it's a sprained ankle, you may need to convince them to stop stressing that leg as much to give it time to heal. So the approaches to cures for that kind of condition are so very different, even though the observable symptoms are the same, that once you've narrowed down what it is to something, you know, that's more than the observable symptoms, that's when you can really start to help. And so that's why it's important to have, you know, a range of criteria rather than just, oh, a limp means a sprained ankle.
And I kind of have, and I don't know if we should take a break before this or not, but I kind of have something that I've noticed symptom-wise between children and adults that I don't know if people would necessarily be aware of.
I think we should have the break and let people wonder that is what that is.
Ponder that for a few minutes.
Okay, let's take a break, and I will throw out the statement and contemplate it on the break, and when we come back, you guys can comment on that. Here's the statement. This is what I'm understanding. There can't be proper treatment without accurate diagnosis. And the second part to that, is there different skill levels among professionals who diagnose this? Very important. I'm saying yes. I'm sticking to it. We're coming back.
All right.
Hopefully, you'll never have to experience a disaster such as a fire or a flood striking your home or business. But if you do, know there's someone out there who can quickly help you get life back to normal. That someone is ServiceMaster by Disaster Professionals. Just call 602-431-2222, and our professionals will be there to lend a hand. You can be confident knowing ServiceMaster Clean has over 50 years of experience restoring damaged homes and businesses after frightening events such as fires, floods, vandalisms, and other disasters. We can offer services such as emergency cleaning, smoke, soot, and odor removal, in addition to water and fire damage repair. Our solid reputation is the reason insurance companies nationwide know ServiceMaster Clean will get the job done quickly and professionally. Plus, we guarantee to do the work right the first time, or we'll do it over with no questions asked. That's ServiceMaster Clean. We're the company that's first to respond to your call, first to arrive on the scene, and first to guarantee relief. Because delays and hassles are the last thing you need. Remember, 602-431-2222 for ServiceMaster Clean by Disaster Professionals. And get the clean you expect and the service you deserve.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Are you standing at a crossroad in life wondering what's next? Is it time to reinvent your relationship, your career, your life? Whether you're ready for a reinvention revolution or a reinvention evolution, the support of a couple of great coaches can get you there. When you decide it's time to take your life from just functional to optimal, call Joe and Lori Battaglia of Living the Dream Coaches. 888-505-5762. That's 888-505-5762, or go online to www.livingthedreamcoaches.com. That's www.livingthedreamcoaches.com.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac, and this is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston. Hey, weather much better today, Paul.
Oh, yeah, yesterday. It's pretty nice here today.
It was cold yesterday. Did you notice
cold,
that?
Rainy,
freezing.
Wet.
There was ice on the grass this morning.
There was?
Yeah, my dog was sort of like, what's that? He was afraid to walk on it. He kept
really?
Lifting. Yeah.
He's not a snow dog, is he?
No.
Oh, no.
He's a desert rat dog.
Wow. Now, we did leave off by saying there can't be proper treatment without accurate diagnosis. That was a statement I just said, so you can comment on it. And different skill level among professionals. That's interesting. I'm also going to say one more thing. I learned from, yes, it was NLP. There's no such thing as inflexible patients, only inflexible therapists. Think about that.
Interesting.
All right, we'll talk.
I think I would actually disagree with that.
The wording of that.
Well, no, I think I would disagree just with almost the idea that I think that technically any patient is to a degree inflexible because they have a condition. A broken leg is not going to be talked into being just a sprained ankle. Whatever condition they have, that's set in stone until you start working on it. So there are inflexible doctors, but an inflexible doctor is one who doesn't recognize that it's up to them to address whatever problem is before them. So
I think we're saying the same thing, though.
Yeah, well, I think, though, that
no such thing as inflexible. In other words, where this came from is Leslie Cameron Bandler, the mm-hmm. wife of the ex-wife of co-founder Richard Bandler of NLP. Now, what happened is they started to notice there's a lot of therapists out there that if they can't do something, they blame the patient.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're not ready. Richard Bandler, Milton Erickson, all of them said, no, we can make the client ready. We're so good at what we do. It's up to us as masters to change our style to get through to the patient. I sort of like it.
Well, I think that would be... There's no such thing as a patient that can't be helped, only an inflexible doctor, which
that's
is a little different.
Okay.
That's the better
Nicely
word.
Done.
Yeah, that's
the better so phrasing. Smart. This Paul guy is
good.
Brilliant.
I know, he's good with
words. You are good.
Well, words are very important to me because Kim was talking about those people who take words literally and things like that.
That
words have always been a passion of mine, finding the right ones, because that was, for the longest time, the only tool I had to avoid a most misunderstanding on emotional issues was making sure that I picked the clearest possible words to express what I was trying to say so that there was as little as possible ambiguity.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
So that's one thing I picked up.
And that could be hard, too. I mean, I know, Paul's saying that that was what he experienced. I know some other people who had similar experiences. And what happens is it's so frustrating for the individual because here you are putting all this careful thought into your communication, and then the feedback that you're getting is potentially, still negative or just not making sense or whatever. And it's really, I would think, just kind of a bummer, like, to put that much thought. And then you're thinking, why aren't they putting as much thought as I'm putting in? And there's just a lot of...
Gotcha.
So focusing on the words alone, even though I could see, in a logical sense, it's like, well, why do we have words? I mean, that makes sense in a way to why aren't we using them in a more uniform way? I can understand that side of it too, but it just causes kind of a lot of relational stress and misunderstandings. And that's actually, speaking of the thing I wanted to bring up before the break, is another, I guess you could say, observable symptom would be something along the lines of that kind of interaction where, you're experiencing an interaction with a person, and I'm thinking of adults mostly right now, not so much children, but, you're conveying your intent, maybe facially and gesturally, and you might be getting heated up about something, and the person you're interacting with is just not really seemingly getting it or being able to take note of your affect and coordinate affect with you. That is a potential sign that maybe they're not able to process intent beyond words. And sometimes that's just another feeling you get. Some people might say, well, they just don't care. Why aren't they getting mad? Because I'm getting mad.
Or I'm not getting through to you, right?
Right. Or why aren't they shifting in some way? Now, that doesn't mean both parties have to be mad together. That's not really what it means. But there's some kind of adjustments that go, like in a flow. And somebody who seemingly has like no adjustments at all or observation of it. The reason I'm bringing it up in adults is because what happens is the adults I see, they get labeled these mean things. Like they don't care. they're heartless, you know, things like that. And that's not the case. In fact, every adult that I've seen has like the most kindest, really big hearts, but people aren't able to see past what they just don't understand.
You know, and that's a good lesson for people also not on the spectrum, because people that are, let's say, I'm going to just say, quote unquote, one dimensional. If the only way they think people care is by how they process caring, they're missing a lot of other possibilities.
That's really common.
And that happens a lot.
That's pretty yeah.
Especially between men and women.
Well, yeah.
That's a different show.
But no, because we process differently. Well, it's the same with autism. If you're processing something differently than another person, it's not like you're not on equal ground. So how would you, I mean, whatever communication you're attempting, if you're not kind of in the same field, I guess you could, you know, playing field, how in the world is it going to go well or evolve or
That would be good, though, for marriage counseling.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, it's very common, isn't it?
Well, lately, too, I've been seeing a lot of people who one of the spouses is just getting diagnosed and they've been fighting and fighting and they never knew why.
It was just like, interesting.
Oh, yeah. And now it's like, oh, so the spouse that, you know, isn't diagnosed will start reading and go, well, that makes perfect sense. I just thought he didn't care.
Yeah,
or I just thought he was being controlling the way he would talk to me or, you know, and it's like, no. I mean, to what degree the personality stuff is, I'm not sure. But when you look at the actual deficits, it's like, okay, that's why when, you know, we were unable to understand each other.
So this could be big if you think about it. So of all the people out there maybe that are married or in a relationship right now, and if someone doesn't know or neither party knows one might be on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Wow, their issues could be solved fairly easily by a little bit more understanding.
Well,
understanding. No?
Well, no.
She says no, Paul.
No.
Help me out.
I wouldn't
this
say
one.
Easily.
No.
I think that's the trigger.
No, I mean even
that
once
was the trigger.
Even once you know though. So let's say some of the people I see. Okay, so now they're kind of like relieved.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why this is happening.
That's not enough.
It
you're
doesn't.
Saying.
No.
Okay.
No, it's still quite difficult. However, at least you have a different.
But is it half the battle? You think?
At
least that awareness.
I would say that
it's what allows you to start the battle.
Okay,
like,
good.
Until you've got that clear diagnosis, you don't really have a starting point. I mean,
that's a good point.
If you take a, quote, neurotypical person and someone who's on a high-functioning autistic in a room, and if you had someone who was completely, this is hard to imagine, but if say we had a non-human intelligence, a computer, an alien, someone else observing them, they wouldn't be able to tell which of them had the disorder because both of them would be failing to communicate with each other and both of them would be missing the kind of signals and feedback the other one gives.
Mm.
That it's not necessarily, I mean, with lower functioning autistic people, it's sort of easier to tell that there's something wrong, but that's usually because there are comorbid conditions.
Right.
The autism itself is primarily an emotional impairment, an emotional development impairment. And it leads to someone who interprets a lot of the common signals that we give in different enough ways that it's clear that there's something wrong to us. But a lot of times it's clear there's something wrong to us because we have a consensus among us of what is right, and we have someone who's offset. And that makes communicating with them very difficult because the person who's sort of normal has the very same challenges reaching the person who's autistic as the person who's autistic has reaching the normal person.
Oh, nice.
So it's a two-way thing, and neither of them necessarily has the language to figure out where the gap is and what's wrong until you get a third person who's more of an expert in to sort of step in and help start building the bridge.
Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, again, that's why accurate diagnosis is so important, is because until you have a good diagnosis, you can't start figuring out what really went wrong, and it can be very hard to spot in someone that you've known for a long time and you've gotten used to their quirks or whatever. So, you know, that's one of the things, like we were talking about yesterday, DSM-4 is becoming the DSM-5. There's a lot of worry about it, but the goal of it is to take some of the subjectivity out of diagnosis, that they've tried to clarify the language, narrow it down to very specific points that, you know, at different drafts they've looked different ways, and we won't know until it actually comes out how good or bad it is. But the goal of it is to make sure that doctors can be clearer about what autism is so that they're not diagnosing additional conditions. They're not diagnosing things that go with autism like speech development delays, but that they're saying, okay, this person has autism and speech development delays, or has, you know, that they know which symptoms are probably the autism and which symptoms are other things that they also need to look at so that you can better get the help that you need. Because, again, accurate diagnosis is important. And I think, you know, what might be important, that a lot of people are worried about losing their autism diagnoses. And again, we won't know how many people will lose it. There's been studies anywhere from 10% to 75%, and some of those say that, you know, they'll lose it entirely. Some say they'll be diagnosed with something else. If things are working right, diagnosis is about helping you get the treatment you need. And this is sort of a heavily scientifically based book. It's based on the results of studies and other things showing, you know, which methods have been accurate in the past and which methods haven't. If it works out right, which I'm not saying it will, but if your diagnosis changes, maybe that'll mean that you'll get a better treatment for
more
you, because there are
path.
A lot of things that look like autism that aren't. That
yeah.
It's because it's such a spectrum and because it's such a fuzzy thing that maybe if you end up in another category, that means that you're going to see someone who's an expert in that category who might be able to help you better. So it's a tough thing right now looking forward to see where it's going to be in 5 years or 10 years, because I think we won't know whether this is a good revision until we see, you know, the next generation of people who go through it, go through their diagnosis with it, see experts from it, and we see what the outcomes are. Because you can't look at the starting point and predict the outcomes for neurological conditions. You just can't.
And especially autism. It's so complex.
So there's listeners out there right now saying, okay, maybe my child may have some symptoms that might look like this. What do they do? What's the starting point? Where do you go for a diagnosis?
Well, that's a good question, because not everybody is qualified to actually give a formal diagnosis. Sometimes professionals in your life may try to, like teachers or school psychologists, and say, oh, that's autism. They're actually not supposed to be doing that.
Oh.
You know, at least here in Arizona, they're not supposed to be doing that. So some licensed clinical psychologists are able to do it. Psychiatrists are able to do it. There are certain trained professionals in related fields, like certified in the ADOS. Yesterday, Dr. Nichols was talking about the ADOS. Well,
what is that ADOS?
It's an autism diagnostic observation test, basically. And it's the most, I guess, as far as consensus goes, the most accurate test to diagnose autism.
And who gives that?
Someone has to be certified to do the ADOS to do that.
So it's quite a specialty.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's not the only way to diagnose. But like I said, you really have to make sure that the developmental pediatricians can do it. You just have to make sure that you are getting, you know, the diagnosis from a qualified person. So that's something to ask, you know, the professional that you go see. But yeah, not every school psychologist is qualified to do that. Sometimes they overstep and they're not supposed to. So you just have to check out the credentials and qualifications of the people that you're listening to. Now, that's not to say they haven't observed, you know, important things. But as far as a formal diagnosis, it's not just anyone. I mean, even me, technically, I am not allowed to give a formal diagnosis. I'm not a diagnostician,
and
no.
If you have doubts about the diagnosis, I mean, don't be afraid to ask something like, you know, well, okay, it's clear my child is having troubles and you think they might be autistic. Can you recommend someone who can give a formal diagnosis?
Yes.
So that way,
oh, yeah.
You're not challenging them saying this is wrong, you're still, you know, saying, well, I want a formal diagnosis.
Yeah.
Maybe let them know, you know, for future, you know, state support or whatever, but... You know, never, ever, ever be afraid to ask for a recommendation for a formal diagnosis.
Right. No, it's a better choice to do that. And it's good to get second. I mean, I am sort of a fan of second opinions.
And also, just as another thing is, don't be afraid of the diagnosis of autism. You know, that as a parent or whatever, you may be like, well, I don't want my child to be autistic. Or, there's a lot of hang-ups about it. But at the same time, if your child needs help, if your child really does need help, and you'll know when your child does because you're having that conversation, that having the diagnosis can help your child get the help they need. Earlier is better, as everyone says, but any time is good. And the help is going to be so much better if you put whatever it is aside and start looking for help as soon as, you know, you start seeing warning signs. Because honestly, if you look at it and you say, well, this could be autism, and you go get a diagnosis and they say you're not, it's not, you're going to be relieved. If you say, well, I don't want it to be autism, so I'm not going to go seek a diagnosis, you're going to be stressed the whole time. If you get a diagnosis, then you're going to start working on it, and it's going to get better, and you're going to see it getting better. So the worst possible outcome is you don't get a diagnosis, and it is autism, and you see things getting worse and worse.
And I've seen that, too. Parents who are afraid, and, you know, everyone's entitled to their own feelings, but afraid to get a diagnosis of autism, and they will not pursue that avenue at all in terms of therapies or recommendations from doctors. They will actually actively seek people to kind of side with them in a way. I've seen that a few times, and it's really kind of surprising to me. But at the same time, I think that people's impressions of autism have just been such a dramatic, you know, negative thing. I mean, and I understand, obviously, it presents a tremendous amount of difficulties. But I think, you know, and if you are listening and you're a parent or a family member who is struggling with that issue, it's perfectly acceptable and a good idea for you to go to counseling to work through something like that so you can be in a good place to help the person that you want, that you know needs help. So
is there any type of reference list anywhere? Like, is there an association or some type of place where people can get recommendations?
You know what? There are. I know, like, here in Phoenix, and I know we have listeners all over the world. In Phoenix, you can visit the Autism Society, the Greater Phoenix chapter. And after this next break, I can share the website. I just have to look it up be certain. And also, you know, the ASA, the Autism Society of America, the United States Autism Society overall, they have a website. And then, you know, individual groups, you know, such as, I know Autism Speaks is a big one in this country, and they do have a list of resources. Now, if it's a more, you know, you're looking for specific cities and things, it's a little bit, you know, trickier, because here in Phoenix, we don't know, you know, all professionals in every city. But actually, once we get our website going, it would be really cool to have some kind of resource page that we can have some of you who are listening who've had good experiences with professionals and professionals who know other professionals. Maybe we could put together some kind of contact sheet, too. But I would suggest starting with those sites. And also, word of mouth is really good. Talking to other parents about their experiences. Usually that's how people, you know, say, oh, I went to this person. It was really great. And this is why. And you know, that sort of thing. That's what I've noticed to be helpful for a lot of the people that contact
me. And I know a great radio show that can be a resource. Understanding Autism. Let's take a break right now. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon, stars of Understanding Autism. We're talking about symptoms and diagnosis. Very important to, well, just to be aware, actually. And we'll try to get that website right after the break here, and we'll be right back.
Beerum Baum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl.com.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac, and this is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Alden all the way from Houston. I got to just really honor, shout out for Paul. His dedication, his passion to help people, flying out every month. Congratulations, Paul. I mean, it's beyond that. You're just a great human being.
You know, the truth be told, I just like to talk about things that I know about. So,
pick another topic
that I know about, and I'll just do just as much. So,
yeah,
but it takes. But a lot
I recognize it in you that you have such passion.
He's modest.
Yeah, you are modest. You're helping a lot of people, and really, I mean, just imagine all the parents that are scared, that are so grateful for a show like this that you're both giving from your hearts and souls. I like it. I'm going to stick to it. Let's get back to the show. Symptoms and diagnosis. All right, so we did get that website, right?
Oh, we did, yeah. Let me just...
It's phxautism.org.
Thank you. He has the good memory.
Okay,
here.
Say it again.
It's www.phxautism.org.
And that's for the Autism Society, the Greater Phoenix chapter. So, you know, again, if you're here in Phoenix, that would be quite applicable to you. And then if you also just Google Autism Society of America, you can find their link and resources. And then the other one that I know of just off the top of my head is Autism Speaks. And they do actually have a lot of resources on there. I was just on there recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And those things, those last two are national related things. So those are good resources. And, you know, for people interested in RDI, Relationship Development Intervention, that's the therapy that I do. We have certified consultants all over the world, and we do have a resource list, you know, on the site, and that's www.rdiconnect.com.
Nice. So there's plenty of resources out there.
There really are. You just have to kind of sort through them and take time to do some research.
Nice. And, of course, if you missed any part of the show, you can always go back to BreakRadioShow.com, BreakRadioShow.com. Go to archives, look for Understanding Autism, and play back any of your great shows. How long has it been now? A couple of years?
It's been about 2.5 now, I think, because we started in October, November, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I think you're right. So there's a lot of great topics, a lot of great shows.
We're also on iTunes. You forgot to mention.
Oh, iTunes, yes.
Yeah.
I have an iPad.
If you search iTunes for Understanding Autism in the podcast area, you'll find us as one of the first ones. You can look for our heart logo.
Free podcasts of previous shows for
nice.
People. And I love that feature, to be honest. I'm even like raving about it for ourselves. But for those of you who have, you know, smartphones and iPads and all that sort of thing, it's portable.
Yeah.
Then you, like on my phone, you know, I can just download it from iTunes and then you can do an automatic download and it's like always there.
Wow. That
the convenience factor is amazing.
It is really technology. It's just cooking. So anyway, we're talking about symptoms and diagnosis. Now, where do you want to go from here? Did you want to talk about some other symptoms or more about the processes?
Well, I know I kind of lost track at the break. We started talking and I was like thinking, okay, I was talking about some of the recent phone calls that I've received you know, married couples. And, you know, I'm just trying to think. I mean, I kind of have a specific focus on the older population, like the adults. I tend to like to talk about them a lot more. But what I can say is, you know, in children and adults, symptoms with children, you know, things like they aren't playing appropriately with toys or they're lining up toys. They're doing repetitive behavior with toys, not being able to pretend play, not seemingly wanting to interact with other kids or be able to reciprocate with other kids. Those are some pretty obvious behaviors that one might see in a child and have some question marks over. Now, when you're an adult, it's a little different. Because there's no toys, you know, there's not someone exactly watching you either to observe you. So what's trickier for the adults is they don't really have someone a lot of times to kind of say, hey, there's some question marks here. Now, the people that I've talked to, I have had a couple people who said, you know, I was, you know, at a job interview and somebody was able to politely say, you know, so I'm just wondering about this for you because I've seen your resume and meeting you, you know, so some people are polite enough. I mean, and it's tricky because you don't know how someone's going to take it. For adults to have somebody kindly sort of say, you know, maybe you should go check this out. A lot of times that doesn't happen. Instead, they get a lot of negative feedback. And so symptoms for adults really relate a lot of times to more social related type things and also self-awareness type things. Something like just having a level of self-regulation. Like I've worked with somebody who, when he gets, you know, upset about something, he has no kind of regulating mechanism. So he doesn't have any kind of neutral range. He'll go from 0 to 100 very quickly and in the wrong timing, in the wrong setting. And it's not that he's mean. It's not that he's a jerk. He's unable to emotionally regulate himself. And so sometimes when you're in social settings and you see something, or if I were to see something like that, that would be a big clue for me, too, is just the timing of choosing when to communicate, so, you know, the awareness of, you know, the pacing, the tone, the voice, all of that. For adults, those are more obvious symptoms than they are for children.
So that's good. I mean, that's good to at least be aware. It doesn't mean you're on the spectrum, right?
No, it doesn't mean you're on the spectrum.
But it means there's something to take a little bit notice about.
Yeah, and just start to observe. I call them question marks because I like to keep them in my mind and say, let me just keep an eye on this and then go from there.
But either way.
No jumping to conclusions ever.
Yeah.
We're in a state of hypothesis all the time here.
Oh, nicely done. Good theory. But either way, if someone has that lack of self-regulation, in either case, it's probably, there's probably some enhancements that are just waiting for them.
That's true.
I mean,
when it affects somebody's quality of life,
yeah.
And I mean, from my perspective, everybody should have the best quality of life and what's meaningful to them. That doesn't necessarily mean what's meaningful to them is meaningful to me. But if people are having issues and you see that it's causing them, like stress and depression, I mean, whether it's autism or not, it's a good idea to be supportive. I mean, either way, because, yeah, not all of these things mean, ooh, autism, but there's a lot of things that people experience that aren't autism that may look social or emotional. And so it's just important not to jump to any conclusions or point fingers or anything like that. It's just stuff to observe and think about.
There's always room for improvement in general.
That's true.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yes. And remember, we have announcements. So
yes.
Just keeping tabs on the time.
Why don't we do it? We only have about 2.5 minutes left. 2 minutes. Okay. Announcements.
Well, one thing, I will be speaking at the 14th annual conference of the Autism Society of Greater Phoenix, the spring conference, which is, I will be speaking on Friday, April 5th in the evening. I think it's 4:15.
And you can sign up for you can register for this conference. It's actually a 2-day conference, and Pa is one of the breakout speakers.
Nice.
So if you go to that www.
phxautism.org.
phxautism.org. I can't remember that stuff. You can learn more about the conference, and you can register for the conference that way. And, of course, sign up for Paul's breakout session.
I'll be giving a talk on using the tools that we use to understand and talk about culture to better bridge the gap between people on the autism spectrum and everyone else.
Wow. And we're excited. You'll get to meet us. We'll all be there.
I will be there, too. I will take off my sports show, let Mr. Greg handle the show. I'm looking forward to your breakout speaking.
And maybe we'll even get some t-shirts together by then. Let's make that a priority.
That's a good idea. Wow. What other announcements? We have 60 seconds.
Well, we always want you to check out our Facebook page. And we love comments and questions and things like that. So ideas for future shows. We love that. We're still working on our website. Thank you for your patience. We're in the process of constructing that and getting that all together. And we have a great guest for next month. You want to talk about our guest for next month?
Next month I have, I can't remember his name on the spot. I didn't come prepared. We have one of the project leads for a game called Happy Action Theater by Double Fine Studios that's being used in autism treatment and therapy in Australia and other places.
Yeah. I love it. We only have a few seconds left. Have a great day. Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you, Paul Alden, Kim Isaac. And see everyone tomorrow. Breakthrough Sports, Real Hockey Talk. Good action. See you tomorrow.